Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. It's our fourth function for the week, so it's been a busy week. But Geoffrey Simpson was in town, and it was the only night on which he could come here, and Geoffrey Simpson has been at the Sydney Institute before, and Anne and I have kept in touch with him on our occasional visits to Canada, and so it's great that he's back in Sydney and addressing the Sydney Institute. So I'll introduce our two speakers. Geoffrey Simpson, perhaps Canada's best known commentator, a journalist of long standing, an author. His most recent book was on climate change, and his next book is on healthcare, both topics of considerable interest in the current debate in Australia. Professor Anne Toomey at the University of Sydney is an academic, but also a constitutional lawyer and a well-known commentator on legal and constitutional matters in Australia. She's also an author, and her next book will be on the Australian Acts of 1986 and the Hawke government and the relationship between Australia and Britain. But tonight we're discussing the topic of minority government, Canada and Australia, which is very current in both countries. And we're going to lead off with Mr. Simpson, followed by Professor Toomey. You're both welcome, and off we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerald. Ladies and gentlemen, very nice to be with you again at the Sydney Institute. This is my fifth trip to Australia, and this one has deepened my affection for and deepened my interest in the country. This morning, Paul Kelly, who was at our Canada-Australia Business Forum, used a word that I thought was appropriate, which is benchmark, because every time I come here and every time I read about Australia or I talk to Australians, I believe that for Canada, this is the country against which we can most usefully benchmark ourselves. And I like to think that that might be the case for Australia, but that's for you to say. So every time I come here, I pick up the newspapers. I don't know all the players, of course. The details are not known to me, but the essence of what you're nattering on about, I get pretty quickly, faster than I do in almost any other country, except the United States. But they do things in such a very different way that it's interesting to watch them. But they're not as relevant from a benchmarking point of view. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Mexico City at the Trilateral Forum, Commission rather, and we had a number of presentations from Mexicans, and it was in the few days after the midterms in the United States. And the thought struck me, listening to the Mexicans and the Americans, and knowing that I was coming down here, that if you look around the loosely defined Western democratic world at the moment, most of the Western democracies are now run by whatever you want to call it, divided or minority governments. Some of them are always that way because they're proportional representation systems, and they are designed to reflect votes and seats in such a way that nobody, except under the rarest circumstances, is ever going to have a majority. So it's not surprising that Germany has a coalition. And I was there soon after it was formed, and in very German style, they had a 76-page, highly detailed document as between the three parties that formed the coalition. The Swedes just had an election, and they have a center-right coalition. Our New Zealand friends have a coalition, because that's what the MMP system is always going to produce, except under the most extraordinary circumstances. So that category of countries is always going to be minority governments. But then you have these presidential systems which have structurally divided governments, executive and legislature being separate, but now you've overlaid on top of that party differences as well. So in Mexico, President Calderon from the PAN party lost in the midterm elections. His party lost the majority in the Mexican Congress. And of course, you all know what happened in the midterms in the United States. So divided government is now overlaid with divided party government. And in parliamentary systems, which are supposed to most often produce majority governments, in Britain and in Canada and in Australia, you've now all got minority governments. So you look around and you say, well, France has a president who still has his party still has a majority in the Assembly, Assemblée Nationale, which is probably the only reason they got the pension reform through, despite the street demonstrations, which are part of French political life. Maybe the Japanese, I'm less familiar with the Japanese situation. But at any rate, it's just, I don't know whether it's simply a matter, and it could be nothing more than coincidence, that for a variety of reasons which have only to do with individual countries, you've got a majority of them now run by divided governments, or whether there's something more systemic going on having to do with the frittering of national parties that makes it more difficult for parties now to get majorities in certain democracies. I leave it to you. I just make the observation that what we're discussing tonight is part of a somewhat wider pattern, if I can put it that way, at the moment. Now, as for our situation, we have had, since 1867, when Canada came together, as you did in 1901, some minority governments. 1925-6, 1962-68, 1972-74, 1979-80, 2004-2008. Now, the one in 1925-26 lasted only a few months. In 62-68, there was a one-year government, there was a two-year government, there was a two-and-a-half-year government. 72-74, a two-year government. 79-80, 6 months. And now, since 2004, the governments have averaged about 2 years. So, what are the lessons that this Canadian situation might offer? Well, the first is that minority governments historically are the exception to the rule. However, in the last 50 years, 15 of those years have had minority governments. So whereas in the previous 100-odd years it was very rare, it's now becoming more or less unusual to have minority governments. Secondly, the governments have lasted at a maximum 2.5 years, and on the mean, less than 2. Now, none of these governments, unlike the one you have now, and unlike the one in the United Kingdom, ever was a coalition. They were always formed of a government, didn't have enough seats in the House of Commons, that survived week by week, month by month, either because none of the parties found it opportune to have an early election, or because certain bill-by-bill arrangements were made between the government and one of the opposition parties to keep the Queen's business going so that the government stayed in office. So there were always political circumstances. There was no 76-page Germanic document. There was no written agreement that kept these governments going. And maybe that's one of the reasons why they proved to be governments that on average lasted less than 2 years. And maybe therefore in Australia, where there is a kind of coalition, although not between parties or among parties, but between a party and certain independents, there might be an opportunity for greater durability. You will see on that. I'm simply saying in our history, these are the numbers. 2 years, a little less is the mean. 2.5 has been the maximum, but no coalitions. The third point is that in about half of these circumstances, the government fell, the minority government fell, because it wanted to fall. Because it thought that the timing was opportune to have an election, that things had gotten better for them since they fell into a minority, and that if they precipitated an election, they could win a majority. And in the other half of the cases, they didn't want to lose, but the opposition parties thought that it was in their interest to bring the government down. So there's no pattern as to whether governments fall because the government wants it or the opposition. Each depends on particular circumstances. Number four lesson, I think, is clearly the more parties you have, or independents in your case, the greater the likelihood is you're going to have minority governments. Now, for decades in Canada, we had two big parties and one much smaller party on the left of the spectrum, a kind of socialist and then social democratic party. And therefore, the reason why we had majority governments was because we had two big parties and one very small one. When we fell into minority governments back in the 60s, or 1979, it was because a fourth party grew up, usually in the province of Quebec. And therefore, it became difficult for one of the big parties to put a big majority of seats together because there were two opposition parties grabbing a certain number of seats. When you take a large number of seats out of the parliamentary equation and put them into small parties, the arithmetic is obvious. It's much harder to form a majority in parliament. If you look at some of the proportional representation systems, and I realize this is an aside, they tend over time to produce a larger number of parties. Because if people are trying to match votes with seats, it's in their interest to vote, as it were, narrowly. So in Germany, now part of it's because of unification, and so some of the lefties from the East Germany have become part of the left party. There are now six parties in Germany, whereas when I first started writing about German politics, there were three. Number five, and this will be very interesting to see in Australia. We have not been able to change the political culture of Parliament, and indeed of the country, to take account of the fact that we now have minority governments. Our parties still operate on a highly majoritarian parliamentary set of assumptions. That there's them over there and there's us over here, and we're going to fight like cats and dogs every day, and we're going to spin everything that happens to our tactical advantage, because a breakthrough is going to come at some point that will allow us to get back into a majority. The notion that the electorate has sent a minority government to the capital, and that therefore no party has the full confidence of the electorate, and therefore you should try to compromise, to work together, is totally foreign to our parliamentary system at the moment. And the politicians all assume, I mean in the big parties, that this situation is abnormal and that therefore they should conduct themselves as they always have in a majority situation. You dare the other side. You force the other side. You criticize the other side. You don't try to cooperate. So, the habits of mind apparently are very difficult to shape for political parties that think that the next time they're going to get the majority. The last point I'd make is that in my experience, and years ago when I was a young man, I had a thing called a parliamentary internship that let me work on Parliament Hill, and we had a minority government, 72, 74. So I actually saw as a young kid what it looked like from the inside, and I've observed it from the outside. And there isn't any doubt that minority governments shrink timetables. Now, you may be different in Australia because you may have 3 years of relative peace with this coalition with the independents. But generally speaking, I would say minority governments shrink timetables and horizons. There's a great emphasis in minority governments on tactics, because you're not sure whether you're going to survive for very long. So you have to get whatever temporary advantage you think you can out of the events of today. The notion that you should do something extremely unpopular and go into the teeth of public opinion because you hope that 4 years from now, or 5 years from now, because we can go 5 years in our system, you might be able to have persuaded the electorate that this was actually a good thing, That's completely foreign to a minority government. You're always trying to wrong foot the other side in a minority government. In 1979, we had a government that came into office, introduced a budget, a very brave budget. They gave it the slogan, short-term pain for long-term gain. Now, this was very foolish politically on their part, because the electorate saw these short-term pain measures and said, you're out of there. And they stayed out of there for another 4 or 5 years. So it's very risky to do things which are difficult politically. Now, our present situation is that the present government inherited a big surplus from their predecessors. And of course, part of the political partisanship, I guess in all countries, is you never want to give your predecessor credit for anything. So they inherited this big surplus, and they began, the conservative government, to spend a lot of money. And they haven't really made any hard decisions yet. I mean, really hard ones in terms of flying in the face of public opinion since they got into office. So where are we now? Well, as I said, we have a minority. We've had three in a row, one liberal, two conservatives. But we don't have a coalition. We don't have independents as you do. And a coalition would require, without independents, two of our parties getting together and either signing a document or coming to some kind of an understanding that would keep things going for a while. That hasn't happened. Now, the biggest obstacle to that happening, I have to say, and I'm not going to go into great detail here, we can in the question period if you're masochistic enough to want to, is that for the last six elections, a party called the Bloc Québécois has won the largest number of seats in the province of Quebec, and their raison d'être is to take Quebec out of Canada. Now, they don't really campaign on that during their election campaign. What they campaign on is, we are the defenders of Quebec's interests. They don't say, vote for us and we're going to have a referendum on sovereignty, because that's not within their power to grant. That's a provincial government matter. So you can't have one of the big federal parties having a coalition, even in theory if you wanted to, with a political party whose long-term aim is to break up the country. That just won't work. So that has one of the reasons why coalition is difficult. About 18 months ago, there was a sort of parliamentary crisis, which is what can happen in minority governments. When the government was in difficulty in the House of Commons, and the principal opposition party, the Liberal Party, and the center, the left of center party, the New Democratic Party, got together and decided that they were going to take over with a coalition supported by the Bloc Québécois, but not part of the coalition, because remember, they can't make a deal with separatists. So that looked like a coalition in the making, except that the Prime Minister, so we had a big parliamentary crisis, the Prime Minister said, I've won the election, I have more seats, these two parties lost the election, they have no credibility, they have no legitimacy, and so he shut Parliament down and got permission from the Governor General to do that, which is actually constitutionally right because he'd already won a vote of confidence. Anyway, it produced a big crisis, and that was the last time we heard about coalitions. What we have in the moment, at the moment, therefore, are kind of four, no pun intended, blocks. We've got the Bloc Québécois in Quebec. We've got the New Democratic Party that gets 15 to 18% of the vote, election after election. We've got the Conservative Party, that's got about 33% of the vote, give or take 3 points. And we've got about the Liberal Party that's got 28%, give or take 3 points. And that has been remarkably stable over the last 4 years, despite all the efforts, all the attack ad campaigns, all the announcements, all the spending, all the cross-country touring. Nothing's moved. It's my military analogy, and it's a hackneyed one, is that it's like a First World War battle. The lines are fixed. Energies, immense energies are thrown into trying for a breakthrough, and it never happens. Actually, we're in a rut, tremendous stability. The last thing I'll say before I turn it over to Anne is that if we get, and here I'm out on a limb, I don't know, If we get another minority, which, by the way, if we had an election tomorrow, we would get, or maybe another two minorities, I think you'd see a lot of Canadians starting to ask themselves, okay, we seem now to be in a prolonged period of minority governments, which are therefore no longer abnormal. They are the new normal. So one of two things has to happen. Either the mores and the habits of the political parties in Parliament have to change somewhat, because we keep signaling to them that we don't want to give one party the full majority confidence. We want them to compromise more. They better change their behavior. We don't want to see them shouting at each other all the time. We don't want to see these antics that go on. We want to see them actually trying to work together so that habits develop. Or we say, okay, we're getting de facto minority governments. Why don't we change our electoral system so that the electoral system will give us those, but under a different set of assumptions? Because when you have a proportional representation system, everybody knows that some parties are going to have to cooperate after the election, or sometimes they come together before the election. So let's just change the electoral system so that we're in effect de jure taking account of what's happening de facto. And I just end by saying that we have had three provinces in our country that have tried to change the electoral system in their provinces to forms of proportional representation. British Columbia tried, Little Prince Edward Island tried, and Ontario tried. And in all three cases, the voters, when they voted in a referendum on changing the system from our British first-past-the-post system, we don't have your AV system, said no. Now, my friends who support PR say, well, it was because we didn't get enough time to advance our case, the rules of the plebiscite weren't quite right, etc. All I say to them is, there's a lot of inertia in political systems. It's really hard for people to change that which they know to something that they don't. I mean, I've studied your AV system. I think I can understand it, and I like it. And if you ask me carte blanche what would be the best voting system for Canada, that's the one I prefer. But if you stand up and try to say to people, now look here, your second preference is on this ballot, and you show them an Australian ballot which runs out like this, you know, it's great in theory, but your average Canadian who, you know, gets a piece of paper like this with four names on it, it's a big leap, right? Pardon?
It only has to tick one.
It only has to tick one. I mean, right. And oh, okay. Well, so, I mean, I've seen it. That's PR, right?
The other one's that big.
Right, that big. So it's hard to get people to change from the devil they know to the devil they don't. That's all I'm saying. I know it happened in New Zealand under a very special set of circumstances. It isn't to say that it couldn't happen in Canada. I'm just saying that we've had three cracks at this in provinces big, medium, and small with two different proposals. One was for the Irish single transferable vote system. And I used to say to my friends in BC who like this system, I say, okay, I want you to stand up before the Rotary Club of Chilliwack and explain the Droop quotient to them. I want you to do that. If you can do that, then we'll go for it. And then we had a proposal for the New Zealand MMP system, or a variation of it, in Ontario. That lost in a referendum 2-1. I should just end by saying two other provinces caused committees to be struck to look at changing the system. And both of these committees or commissions actually recommended to the government that they do the same thing, that they put these new proposals to the people, but neither government was interested, and so it hasn't happened. So we're in this period of minority governments that may stretch on for some time yet. And as I say, we haven't found the way to change the mores, the habits, the traditions, let alone the institutions, to take account of what may now be the normal, because the parties are still thinking about our system as if it was old-time majority, knock'em sock'em government. Thanks.
Thank you. Not surprisingly, as a constitutional lawyer, I'm going to take a
perhaps a little bit more of a constitutional approach to the issues. And just thinking to myself, well, what are the main differences between the way a minority government might play out in Australia and in Canada from a constitutional point of view? The thing that struck me most is the role of the Governor-General and the reserve powers of the Governor-General and how they might impact on a minority government is actually, surprisingly, quite different in Canada than it is in Australia. And it's surprising because we actually inherit those powers from exactly the same source, so the powers themselves should be the same. But the reason that they're different is largely reasons of history. In Australia, we are more familiar with the reserve powers because they've been exercised in living memory. We had 1975 and the huge controversy in relation to Gough Whitlam. We've had earlier experience with the 1932 dismissal of the Lang government. And we've had other occasions along the way where there's been a refusal to dissolve parliament, a refusal to prorogue parliament. All those things have happened in Australia. In Canada, in contrast, Geoffrey mentioned the 1925-1926 minority government there. You had a very controversial attempt to exercise, a botched attempt to exercise reserve powers. What happened was that the Governor-General refused a dissolution to the Prime Minister of a minority government, but in the belief that the one of the small parties had defected to the other party, which could form a stable majority government. But what happened was a few days later, that government also fell, and then the Governor-General was forced to give that second Prime Minister a dissolution and was roundly criticised by all through Canada and England and the rest of the world for doing so. And ever since then, Canadian Governors-General have been extremely wary about exercising reserve powers. And if you read any constitutional commentators in Canada on the reserve powers, and I'm thinking in particular of Peter Hogg, who's one of the main constitutional lawyers in Canada, and you read their description of the reserve powers, it's much more limited than ours. Hogg, for example, would say that there is no capacity in the Governor-General to dismiss the Prime Minister, except where the Prime Minister has lost the confidence of the Parliament and refuses to resign or refuses to advise a dissolution. But as far as Hogg's concerned, 1932 in Australia, wrong. 1975 in Australia, wrong. Hogg also says that the Governor-General, it would probably be unconstitutional for the Governor-General to refuse to dissolve the Parliament on advice and all those sorts of things. So a much more narrow and limited view of reserve powers in Canada than you'd find in Australia. So in Australia, there's a much greater risk that the Governor-General might refuse the advice of a minority government in relation to particular matters. And that makes the situation far more unpredictable from a political point of view. If the players aren't actually sure of the rules and aren't sure what the result of certain actions will be, they have to be a lot more wary in the way they behave because they've got no guarantees of support in the Governor-General. So what I want to do is look at that in three examples of the sorts of problems that could potentially arise in a hung parliament where you've got a minority government. Now, the first situation is royal assent. What happens if the Commonwealth Parliament passes legislation against the will of the government that seriously affects or undermines government policies, government budgetary position, all those sorts of things? Can the Commonwealth Government go to the Governor-General and say, we advise you, Governor-General, to refuse assent to this bill? And if they do that, should the Governor-General comply with ministerial advice, or should the Governor-General comply with the advice that's coming to her from the two Houses of Parliament saying, we have enacted this bill, it's up to you then to give assent to it? Now, the first thing to know is that Section 56 of the Constitution says that you can't vote on a bill that appropriates money unless there is a message from the Governor-General approving that the purpose of the appropriation. So as a general principle, the Parliament cannot legislate in a way that appropriates money if that is contrary to the will of the government, because it's the government that advises the Governor-General to give the message, giving the approval in advance to the appropriation. But there can be contention about that. What if the bill itself doesn't actually appropriate, but somehow legally commits the government to future expenditure without actually appropriating, and therefore obliging the government in the future to appropriate? What if that happened? Or in particular, what if, say, for example, you had in the chair a speaker at the time, the deputy speaker or whatever, from another party, and what if, when the bill came up, the speaker didn't say, this bill is struck out because it's in breach of Section 56. What if they just let it through? And it ends up going up to the Governor-General for assent. What happens then if the government then goes to the Governor-General and said, well, I'm sorry, Governor-General, this bill is contrary to Section 56 of the Constitution? And point number two here is that the courts are most likely to say it's a matter that's not justiciable, which means that the courts will not intervene in the process because they say that this is an internal matter for the Houses of Parliament and it's not our jurisdiction to intervene. So in those circumstances, if it's non-justiciable, if it's a breach of Section 56, the government could conceivably go to the Governor-General and say, well, you, Governor-General, are the last person who can enforce the compliance of the Constitution, and therefore we advise you to do that by refusing assent to this bill that actually breaches the Constitution. What does the Governor-General do then? Does she act on the advice of those ministers in refusing assent, or does she act on the advice of the two Houses of Parliament? Now, that, in fact, is a really difficult and very contentious issue. When I was doing some research a few years ago about royal assent at the state level, I actually rang each government house around Australia and asked them what they did in relation to royal assent, and most critically, what they thought they were doing. Did the governor think that he or she was acting on the advice of two houses of parliament as part of the legislature and therefore was fulfilling a legislative act? Or did they think they were acting as the executive on the advice of responsible ministers? And I got some quite interesting responses. South Australia does formally advise the governor through executive council in relation to royal assent. None of the other states do. In none of the other states do any ministers advise the governor to give assent to legislation. It just happens as a matter of course. And so the question then is, well, is it a de facto advice thing, you know, that the governor acts upon that advice if, so long as they're told, you know, so long as nobody tells them not to? So is it some sort of implied advice from ministers? Or does the governor think they're acting on the advice of the two houses of parliament and it's none of the business of ministers? So when I asked this question to the various official secretaries around the country, I got a variety of responses. One official secretary told me outright that as far as he was concerned, his governor was acting on the advice of the two houses of parliament, and if any minister tried to intervene, they'd tell the minister to get lost. Very adamant about that. And in fact, it's quite surprising when you speak to these people. They take a very strong view of the governor as the guardian of the Constitution, and they don't like being bullied by ministers. So fairly sort of bolshy, aggressive point of view. But because it's so rarely ever arisen, and in fact the only circumstances at the state level where it has arisen has usually been in the context of there was a mistake in the legislation, so there was a need to defer assent, or there was some sort of timing problem. Happened actually here in New South Wales, where there was a bill about daylight saving that went through, but they suddenly realised after they'd passed the bill that it was going to cause havoc for all the airlines and other people. You've actually got to organise this well in advance because all the airline timetables don't work otherwise and all the planes are going to crash in the air or some such story. And so in that circumstance, they just delayed assent until the daylight saving period was over so it would come into effect for the next year. So it's happened in those sort of circumstances, but the real crisis comes where you've got a minority government that doesn't have, that got overridden in the parliament, and you've got this fundamental conflict of constitutional principles. On the one hand, you've got representative government and the power of the parliament. On the other side, you've got responsible government and the executive, which is supposed to be responsible for its advice to the parliament. Now, you might say, well, the obvious resolution of that is that if you go with what the ministers say, and if they say something that the parliament doesn't like, then the parliament will vote no confidence in the government and the government will fall and that will be the end of the story. So it's a political resolution, it's not a constitutional resolution. That might be right, but You also have circumstances like we do at the moment where the independents have an extremely vested, strong vested interest in the government continuing its full term, because otherwise they will turn from, you know, roosters to feather dusters come the next election if there's not another hung parliament. So even though they voted for the legislation, they might be unwilling to vote no confidence in a government that overrode the legislation. So you've got this very tense sort of jockeying position, where in Australia there are real doubts as to what the Governor-General's role should be in those circumstances. And you've got commentators supporting both sides. My second example is about prorogation, and this was something that Geoffrey touched on very briefly, the 2008 controversy in Canada. What should a Governor-General do if she is asked to prorogue Parliament by a Prime Minister who is about to face a vote of no confidence in the Parliament? Do you accept the advice of that Prime Minister and prorogue, as the Canadian Governor-General did in 2008? Or do you say, well, if the Parliament itself is not going to allow you to adjourn, why should I, as Governor-General, override the will of the Parliament? It's a matter for the Parliament to decide these matters. Now, let me give you a couple of Australian examples on this. It may be a circumstance where there's some kind of a political scandal that's erupted. The Prime Minister wants the Parliament to be prorogued for a period while that scandal is investigated, so you can have the report of the scandal and you can have evidence back before the Parliament before they undertake the vote on the issue of confidence, so that the issue can be resolved in a more sensible way. Now, that was a situation that arose in New South Wales in 1899. The governor at the time, Earl Beecham, later, by the way, became probably more renowned as the inspiration for Lord Marchmain, for anyone who's read Brideshead Revisited. Earl Beecham was actually his exile from England. I mean, if you read the novel, it was because he had the mistress in Venice. In real life, it was because he was overly fond of the footman. Apparently had the most attractive butler in the whole of Europe, and later caused scandal in Australia when he came back to visit Australia by inviting his valet to come with him to all the society dues. But anyway, I digress. Back to 1899, Earl Beecham was only 27 years old when he became governor of New South Wales. The reason he got the appointment was because he was rich enough to be able to afford it. You actually had to pay yourself to run all your servants and your entertainment at Government House, and unless you were rich enough to do it, you couldn't do the job. So at 27, Earl Beecham came out here. When George Reid was suffering from this political drama, Earl Beecham just said, no, I'm not going to prorogue the Parliament for you, because you're asking me to do it for political reasons. I would only prorogue the Parliament for governmental reasons. And so he refused to prorogue. There was a vote of no confidence against George Reid. He also refused to dissolve. So the government fell, a new government was appointed, and in fact that's potentially the reason that George Reid actually didn't become the first Prime Minister of Australia come 1901. But anyway, Helen could probably tell us more about that. So that's example number one. Example number two is where you have the circumstance we have members of Parliament that die or resign, you want to prorogue until you have the by-election, so you don't want to lose confidence for that short period if you're feeling confident you might win the seat back in the by-election. Can you prorogue for those sorts of reasons? Two examples there. One again in New South Wales, 1911. The Lieutenant Governor refused to prorogue in those circumstances. The government then resigned. They also cunningly took the Speaker out as well, so made the Speaker resign. The opposition discovered that once they had to provide a Speaker, they didn't have enough people to actually run a government either, and couldn't form a government, so the poor Governor, or the Lieutenant Governor at the time, was forced to go back to the Holman government and say, okay, withdraw your resignation and I'll give you your prorogation. And that can show you that there's a real political balance. If you refuse to prorogue and the government resigns but there's no one else that can fulfil the role of a government, then you as Governor are in a bit of a mess. The other example of that was 1971 in Western Australia. The Speaker died. He was a government member. The governor was asked to prorogue until the by-election. The governor did prorogue in those circumstances, but was so worried about what he'd done, he wrote back to England and said, "Have I done the right thing?" This is 1971, still trying to get instructions from the British Foreign Office. And the British Foreign Office replied to say that he had acted within his powers, but they were not prepared to comment on the merits of it, which I don't think was terribly helpful to him. I think, though, it's fair enough to say that when loss of confidence arises as a potential because of a vacancy in seats, it is fair enough in those circumstances to prorogue until the by-elections are held, because confidence should be decided in circumstances where every constituent is represented in the parliament, and it's absurd to change governments on the basis of what might be temporary minority or temporary loss of confidence. However, it's far more controversial to prorogue parliament simply because the government knows it's going to lose a vote of no confidence and wants a period of time to scrabble around and reform government, which is precisely what happened in Canada. And my explanation for why that happened in Canada and why it might be different in Australia is just because we have different views of the reserve powers. Here, we're at least familiar with their existence and we recognise, even though we might all fight till we're blue in the face about whether 1975 was right or wrong, we at least accept that those powers exist, and people would be fairly reluctant, I think you'd find, to remove them altogether. In Canada, I think they have a much more restrictive view of reserve powers after the King Byng affair of 1926. My final point is about dissolution, so dissolving Parliament. Now, at the Commonwealth Parliament, of course, we have flexible three-year terms. The Prime Minister can advise at any time that the Governor-General should dissolve the House. The Governor-General also has a reserve power to refuse to dissolve. Again, this happens extremely rarely, and at the Commonwealth level, not since the very first decade of Federation. But it has happened more recently at state level, at 1950s in Victoria, for example, so on occasion it does. And the reasons why a Governor or a Governor-General can refuse to dissolve include that there's only just recently been an election, and this is a critical thing. If you were Tony Abbott at the moment, you'd have to be sensitive to the fact that if you're trying to knock off the government right now, you don't want to be in the same position of the government of having to keep running the government, you know, with the same sort of independence and all the rest of it and the compromises you have to make. He would want an election. But if you were to ask the Governor-General for election right now, so soon after the previous election, she would have every right to say, no, the Parliament should be given a longer period to run and to refuse an election in those circumstances. The other reasons for refusal to dissolve have been that there isn't enough supply to cover the period, so you need to get supply passed first. And the third one is if another government can be formed that is likely to be a stable government that can survive for a reasonable period of time, you can have a baton change rather than an election after one government falls. And that's obviously not something that's looking like it's likely to happen at the Commonwealth level at the moment, but if you had a fairly significant third party and it swapped horses from one to another, it was clear that that person had a significant majority, you could just move on to that and not have an election in the meantime. In Canada, it's different for two reasons. First of all, Canada nominally has a fixed-term parliament. It's a fairly bizarre form of a fixed-term parliament. It's a fixed-term parliament... here we are in Clayton News. It's a Clayton's fixed-term parliament because... it says, yes, it has to run for 4 years and here's where the next election date is, although it doesn't affect the powers of the Governor-General at all. That's been interpreted as saying that means the Governor-General can dissolve Parliament at any time on the advice of the Prime Minister, which really rather defeats the point of having a fixed term because the Prime Minister can still ask for a dissolution at any time he or she wants. The other odd thing about Canada... What was it? Sorry, the other odd thing is that, the view of commentators like Hogg is that it would be unconstitutional for the Governor-General to refuse to dissolve when asked to do so on advice by the Prime Minister. So in Canada, if you're a minority government, you can be fairly confident that if you want a dissolution, you're definitely going to get one. Whereas if you're in Australia, there is more uncertainty in that. There are circumstances in which the Governor-General could legitimately say no to a dissolution, particularly very early on in the term of a minority government. And that means minority government in Australia is more difficult because of that lack of certainty, because there's that additional wild card in there in the constitutional system of a Governor-General in the political mix, which means that you cannot be absolutely certain of the outcomes of your actions. Thank you.
Hi. Well, thanks, Anne and Geoffrey. I don't look like Jared, sorry about that. And Jared has had to go and left me with it. So firstly, thanks to Clayton Hoots for this great room, because Clayton Hoots is terrific. When we get big, they put us in a bigger room. When we get more intimate, they put us in a more intimate room. We confuse you all. We put it on the emails and everything else, and everybody turns up in the wrong place. So sorry about that. Keep checking the emails. And I'd also like to thank the Canadian High Commission for this, because it's been a great discussion. In fact, there's nothing like minority government to teach us all about just what happens in government. And I've been amazed at how many people who don't know anything about government have learned about government since our election. No doubt that's happened in Canada as well. What we'll do is we'll just take questions, as we always do, either fire it at one or the other, or you can ask both. I'm happy to lead off with a question, or is there someone here who'd like to start? Okay.
Geoffrey, how effective has the Harper minority government been in promulgating a program of government getting things done? Because one of the issues that people are discussing here is whether or not Julia Gillard's actually going to be able to become effectively in terms of the makeup of the federal parliament.
Well, I think he's been quite successful in getting most.
Do you want to come to the microphone here? And
Geoffrey,
sorry.
Yes, that's probably better. I think he's been quite successful. I mean, the budgets he's introduced have gone through, and those are the major documents of any government. I think there have been, I'd have to go and check the record, a few pieces of legislation that didn't get through for whatever reason. For the first half, roughly, of his time in office, the Senate, which is an appointed body in Canada, had a majority of Liberals, because previous governments had been Liberal and they'd appointed their friends. And he, of course, wants an elected Senate, but in the meantime, he's been appointing all of his friends, so they now have a majority in the Senate, so he isn't getting any opposition from the Senate. And as I say, he really hasn't put any water in his wine on pieces of legislation to accommodate the opposition parties. So he's pretty much governed the way he wants. Fortunately for him, the Liberal Party, the principal opposition party, has been in various states of unhappiness with its leader and therefore has been reluctant to go into an election campaign. They don't feel they're strong enough to beat the government. And as a consequence, except for this one constellation in which the three parties very temporarily came together, I think by and large he's been able to get most of his legislation through. Albeit sometimes it's taken longer than the government wants, because it goes into committee and the opposition has the has the votes in committee.
Is it to anyone in particular or just
both? To Geoffrey. 30 years ago when I was living in Canada, we all were exposed to this Quebec independence problem. Mm-hmm. Does that still cause problems politically?
Well, I
today,
said the six straight elections going back into the last decade, the majority of seats out of Quebec in the federal parliament have been won by the Bloc Québécois. So obviously the issue hasn't gone away, except the initiation of a referendum calling for Quebec independence was going to be done by the province, not by the federal parliament. So they're there as an expression of Quebecers' desire to see their interests pursued in the federal parliament by a party that comes exclusively from Quebec. Now, on the provincial scene, the last three elections have been won by a federalist party, and therefore the issue has not been relevant. But, you know, the outs in a democracy, and Quebec is a democratic society, eventually go in, right? And the ins go out. So at some point, the outs there, that's the Parti Québécois that's committed to Quebec independence, will go back into power. Now,
when they do, when that might happen in the next provincial election, because the present government's quite unpopular, they will then go back into office, and they, Article 1 of their constitution is that Quebec should become an independent country. So, in a sense, we might be back to where we were 30 years ago when you were there. The difference is, well, not the difference, the public opinion polls, and this is not a live question, so the questions tend to be more theoretical when you're not actually facing them, show that there's actually not been very much movement over the last 30 years. If you ask a straight-up question, do you want Quebec to become a separate country, or do you want Quebec to become an independent country, or do you want Quebec to secede from Canada, period, it's very, very, very hard to get a majority. I wouldn't say impossible, because nothing's impossible, I suppose. Very hard. And that's why previous referendum questions, and if there's another one, it'll have to be convoluted. Will you give the government a mandate to negotiate sovereignty association? Under certain circumstances, in other words, there'll be all of this sort of cash. Who knows? If you ask a loose enough, vague enough kind of question, and you have a very charismatic leader who comes along, you can maybe push it over 50%.
Separation would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm not in favor of it. I don't think it would be a wise idea for Canada. It would be a tragedy for us, and I think it would be unfortunate for them. But I'm a Federalist, right? Generally speaking, Quebecers don't want that issue on the agenda in a big-time way. They have other fish to fry. But if a political party puts it on the agenda and kind of says, okay, now we're going to deal with it, they will deal with it.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Jeffrey, do you think that a new world order that's driven by, say, mass communications, World Trade Organization, better understanding of economics, has enlightened the electorate to the point that they want more options, and therefore there's the creation of additional parties that drive this new political
well, that's... Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't done enough thinking about this, because you're asking a really good question. Why is it? Is it simply coincidence, or is there something bigger going on that is causing this division of divided governments in a number of countries?
And perhaps Hank could comment on the WTO and how that might impact on the question.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of theorizing, and it's not just theorizing, that sovereignty is moving both up and down. It's going to supranational institutions to some extent, and in some jurisdictions it's going downward as subsidiarity to lower levels of government, which leaves national governments a little bit exposed because their hands are tied with supranational commitments. So that's been going on. In our country, and in yours for that matter, the Greens have come along. Now, I didn't say anything about the Greens. They're obviously very relevant in Australia because they're going to have how many after the 1st of July? 6 in the Senate. And the Senate's elected here and therefore has real power. In our country, the Greens are showing at about 11%, 12%, 10% in a number of public opinion polls. Now, our first-past-the-post system punishes you. If it was a PR system and you got 10% of the vote, you'd have a certain number of seats in the House. But in the first-past-the-post system, it's very difficult to get anybody elected with a 10% national spread. But that's a new factor. That's a new force in both of our politics over the last decade. And it reflects a wider kind of movement that you can see in a number of Western democracies as people begin to be much more concerned about environmental issues and are looking for political vehicles that can express that concern. And they don't see it, apparently, in the traditional old-style parties, if I can put it that way. That's a new equation. That's almost supranational in the sense that one of the issues that galvanizes Greens in many countries is the climate change issue, which knows no national bounds. Obviously, remedial measures are taken by sovereign states, but you compare yourself to what some other state is doing because everybody is part of the global atmospheric commons. I don't know the answer about whether the internet, which tends to be both a disaggregating and an aggregating technology, it aggregates in the sense that you don't have to have a meeting like this. People with common interests can get together, and we've seen very powerful evidence of that when it comes to social movements, fundraising, political activity, across borders even. On the other hand, it disaggregates because it takes people away from traditional organizations like political parties, among others. And there's the Robert Putnam thesis of this kind of disaggregation of traditional places where people demonstrate their civic activity. Bowling alone. They don't join bowling clubs. They don't join the Elks, the Rotary, the PTA, etc., etc. So I think a lot is happening, and I haven't got it all straight as to whether all of these things and others that are occurring are contributing to the effritement, the crumbling, the fracturing of big political parties as people seek more new vehicles to express in a narrower way their particular concerns or ethnicity or religion or interests, whatever they are. I don't know. I just observe that in a lot of big democratic countries, Germany, the big parties aren't as strong as they were before. The Republicans just had a kind of Tea Party phenomenon, although that's inside the political party. In our country, the big parties aren't as strong as they were when I started writing about journalism. Greens are on the scene in a way that they weren't before. Mexico now has three political parties. It used to have two. So this is happening, but can I analyze it and get a grip and form a pattern? I'm not sure I can.
Do you want to comment, Anne, on the sovereignty issue?
No, it's fine. I think you pretty well covered it.
Yeah. First of all, a quick comment and then a question for both of you. Comment to Anne. Thank you very much for that exposition. That has to be, in my short time in Australia, first exposition of minority government that told the listener that rather than paying attention to what Rob Oakeshott or yes. Tony Windsor are doing, he's really worried about Quentin Bryce. So,
yeah.
Which gives us a whole other angle to think about it. The question concerns private members' bills. And I wonder if you can play out for us a little bit how those will, the reserve powers will affect the likelihood of both them passing and triggering the larger consequences that you were spelling out. And maybe, Jeffrey, you could talk a little bit about, because they have become more frequent in recent times under minority governments. We've had, I think, two important, relatively important ones voted down just in this autumn, and many more in the last couple of years. If that's also a part of the goals of minority government, we could hear about it.
Yes, I think that's really interesting. And one thing I was just reading before I came here about private members' bills was about issues of confidence, because one of the problems we have in the Commonwealth Parliament, because we don't have fixed-term parliaments like we do in New South Wales, and in New South Wales it's very clear in the Constitution the circumstances in which a government falls for vote of no confidence. You know, there has to be 7 days' notice of the 4 days' notice of the vote, and, you know, all the rest of it, and it has to be no confidence in the government, etc., etc. Don't have any of that at the Commonwealth level. Therefore, it's sometimes quite hard to see the circumstances in which the government has lost confidence. And one of the circumstances in which a government will be seen to have lost confidence is if it fails to have any of its major legislation passed. But what's quite interesting is that when it comes to private members' bills, if a private members' bill is passed against the wishes of the government, that is generally deemed not to be a vote of no confidence because it's a private member's bill as opposed to an ordinary public bill. So the first part it plays in that is that private members' bills are not regarded as issues of confidence. Having said that, private members' bills can often carry the main policies of an opposition party and therefore can have a substantial impact upon government, and if private members' bills are passed against the wish of the government, it does potentially give rise to those issues I was talking about with royal assent. But Section 56 still kicks in there as well, so if you do have a private members' bill that wants to affect appropriation, if basically that needs to be funded, then so long as Section 56 is functioning, and you know that's a matter for the Parliament itself to control, then those sorts of bills should not get through, even though they're private members' bills. But in terms of frequency of private members' bills, I think we're going to see them much more often. Certainly they've been changing the structure of the debating time in Parliament to allow bills to actually come to a vote, whereas previously they were often just put on the notice paper and then ignored. They never got debated. So we will see issues debated in the Parliament that previously it was interest of both parties just never to get on the agenda. So it's going to open up, I think, quite a lot of the agenda and at least bring things into public and make them debated. But, you know, what actually comes out the other end and how it fits into government and the government's policies and the like, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, Anne just touched on something, Michael, which is that private members' bills can't require the appropriation of money. And since confidence votes are usually around the appropriation of money, they're not, by definition, therefore, going to be confidence votes. We have had a couple of them pass because in a minority parliament, if you can get the three opposition parties, you can get them through. But I still think they're going to be rather rare.
And you, I think in your first point, you talked about, in terms of appropriations, a commitment, a forward commitment. Do you have a ready example of what that might be and where there's been an existing policy?
It's one of those very difficult areas because it's one of those things that, you know, normally don't get litigated. So it's really just a matter of parliamentary procedure as to how you deal with things and how you classify bills and whether they're an appropriation bill or not. The thing that was coming to my mind when I was saying that is that governments, it was actually something quite a little bit different, and that is governments entering into contracts. Because one of the interesting things is that a government, through the executive, can enter into a contract and sign a legal commitment that makes the government legally bound to expend money. So say, for example, some form of public-private infrastructure, you're building the Lane Cove Tunnel or something or other, and you have to give money under that contract to the person who's building it. What's interesting is that that's a legal obligation upon the government. And if there's a court case and the courts say, well, you know, you've broken your contract, you owe the builders money, the court, you cannot, in legal terms, the courts cannot get that money off the government until it's appropriated, but the general view has been taken in government that any legal obligations that are imposed upon it, particularly by a court order or contract or anything else, the government has to appropriate in order to pay those out, because otherwise it would be defying the courts. And so you have this odd sort of circumstance where, on the one hand, Parliament may not want to pass an appropriation bill to fund this particular thing, but the executive has already committed you to it through contract. And so really I was just trying to play with that idea and say, well, if you transfer that over into a private member's bill, so that the bill committed the government to certain sorts of acts, you know, entering into contracts or, you know, commencing some sort of a project, that gave it rise to legal obligations, and those legal obligations would in the end effectively oblige the government or the parliament to appropriate.
Scan whether you looked at any other Commonwealth countries. I seem to recall that New Guinea had lots of dissolutions and changes of governments.
I'm actually doing some work on this at the moment, so if anyone's got any good, particularly on the prorogation issue, the dissolution issue, and the other one I'm working on, by the way, is the issue about what happens when you end up with a change in the party leader, like the movement from Kevin Rudd to Julia Gillard, or in New South Wales, the revolving chairs from Yemma to Rees to Keneally. What happens in those sort of circumstances and what the role of the governor or the governor-general is, you know, do they have to pay attention to what caucus says in terms of choosing a new leader? Or, you know, what happens if Parliament's already been dissolved? Say, for example, with the Kevin Rudd example, if before he went to the caucus meeting that was being held on his leadership, what if he'd gone to Quentin Bryce and said, I'd like an election, please, and she dissolved Parliament? If the rule is that you appoint the person who holds the confidence of the House, but the House doesn't exist, what do you do then? So anyway, That's a bit of a digression, but all these things I'm looking at the moment, and I have been collecting odd bits and pieces, so I've got some good stuff from Malaysia, which has had a number of really fascinating controversies, and again, they use a similar Westminster system to us, even though they're no longer part of the sort of the colonial system, whatever, they're on their own, but they do have the same sort of structures as us. I'm also quite interested in some of the stuff that's happening in the Caribbean. If you've got any good New Guinea examples, I'm collecting at the moment. So, all contributions gratefully received.
Oh, I would never say that. But what I would say is that a minority government puts the opposition in the chair in the committees, right? Let me be more precise. That's wrong. The government is still in the chair, but the majority of the members on the committee are from the non-governing party. If, therefore, the three opposition parties can find common cause on some issue, they can turn the committee in a way that the government doesn't want. I'll give you a very volatile example, quite relevant, well, not relevant to Australia in the sense that the same thing has happened to you, but we're both in Afghanistan. And an issue arose in Canada as to whether the so-called detainees, that is to say, fighters against our soldiers whom we had taken prisoner, were properly treated by the Canadian authorities, military authorities in Afghanistan. We called them detainees. Now, if this had been a majority parliament, and if accusations about mistreatment of prisoners had been raised, you can be pretty sure that the government would have squelched it in committee. But because the opposition parties found common cause and saw something here that could embarrass the government, they decided, over the objections of the government members of the committee, to hold hearings. And various people who had been involved in Afghanistan, including the former chief of the general staff, other military officers, senior diplomats, etc., were hauled before the committee to give testimony as to whether, in fact, something untoward had happened. So that has happened episodically in the last 4 years, where the three opposition parties have found common cause, finding something that they can embarrass the government over, and therefore turning the committees to their advantage over the wishes of the government, who has the chair. And there have been some games that I actually won't go into, where the chair hasn't called committee meetings because obviously he knows that something they don't want is going to happen the next time the committee meets, so they just keep finding reasons not to have the committee meet. And then the opposition screams bloody murder, etc., etc., and the media gets involved, and it's all fun and games. So there is definitely a change when you have a minority government, in the sense that committees can be taken over by the opposition parties if they find common cause. And on some issues, they have.
Question, but just taking up Jeffrey's point, I think there's some examples over the last week, not through committees, but through resolutions of Parliament. For example, the independents and senators combined to force the government to table the NBN business report by a certain time, and to, as I understand it, also to table the blacked out sections of the earlier McKinsey report. So things are going to be quite lively over the next week.
Well, I mean, you can speak to me about whether, if you're an independent that signed up to support the government, I mean, the ones that have signed up to support the government, are you bound to support the government, i.e. not cause any trouble in committees too, or do you reserve the right to be independent in committee?
As I understand it, what they signed up to was only to support, no confidence.
No confidence, but between that they can do what they want. Well, then if our example is relevant to yours, if that's the case, then you can expect the odd committee or more than one committee to be causing much more trouble for the government than if they had a majority. If those independents get an issue or two in their teeth and they find common cause with the opposition, they're going to have more than 50% of the votes on a committee, and they can begin to call witnesses and produce documents and hold the government to the feet to the fire in a way that wouldn't happen if there was a majority. I wasn't aware that they had actually retained that degree of liberty for themselves. Right. But we've had a couple of issues, by the way, which have split the parties. We had a very emotional issue quite recently, and it was a private member's bill on gun control, which is a long-running saga in Canada. It's not gun control. It's whether we should have a registry. If you have a long gun, okay, not a pistol or anything, should you have to sign onto a registry which the police can use? And this has been a very controversial issue over a long period of time, with the conservative forces saying that it's bureaucratic, it really doesn't help deter crime, it stigmatizes the owners of law-abiding hunters and farmers and so on and so forth, and they're very emotionally opposed to this. On the other side, we had a terrible massacre of a number of women some years ago at Université de Montréal, so women's groups are very strongly in favor of this. Many urban dwellers are in favor of it. The country's split 50-50. So a private member's bill arose, and a vote was taken, and it was extremely close. I think it was 155-53 or something like that. And it split one of the parties, the New Democratic Party, maybe 2-1. And that was a private member's bill, and it split the party.
Can I just ask, I'm wondering if there's a difference, that question about our more rigid system. I mean, my reading of history is an Australian federal, a federal level. We haven't tolerated minority government for very long. Whenever it gets messy in Australia, we go right out and vote for a standard government at the first opportunity. You obviously in Canada seeing something quite different. I mean, whether it was Stalin, in 31 or messiness of the Whitney's, whatever. Whenever it gets messy and fractured, we go out and vote for stability. Is there something in the two systems, both coming, that make it more likely that Australia will go back to majority government and more likely that you'll stick with your nice, loose, coalitioning whenever you feel like it?
Well, we've never coalitioned.
Well, I mean, in the sense of getting your votes where you can, all those different parties, whereas we've had to do a deal, get the independents to sign on the dotted line, whatever, and how quickly would a government fall? What would it have to be to make it a no-confidence vote?
Well, I can foresee a circumstance in Canada where we would actually have a coalition. And the circumstance would be this. The Liberal Party, sort of mildly centre-left, mostly centrist, wins the largest number of seats. Okay, they overtake the existing Conservative Party. And the centre-left party, the New Democratic Party, wins X number of seats. And if you put the Liberals and the Democrats together, and they had enough to form 50%, then I could actually see them sitting down and saying, look, rather than having an endless series of elections and being unstable, let's try some kind of a coalition with a written set of principles. Now, that has not been part of our tradition, but they tiptoed up to that in the 2008 experience. They have, I think, very fundamental differences between them. But I know that the former Prime Minister of Canada has been maneuvering behind, Mr. Jean Chrétien, maneuvering behind the scenes to try to get these two parties to think about this. So I could imagine that under those circumstances.
I think one of the interesting things in Australia with sort of third parties has always been that once you actually get them into government in some kind of a coalition or whatever, it usually kills them.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the third party is usually the idealistic party. So it's the Australian Democrats or the Greens or the whoever. The people that come along with the principles that attract a certain proportion of voters. But as soon as those parties either get into government or are put in a position where they have to compromise their principles, like the Australian Democrats did over the GST or whatever, as soon as that happens, I mean, you've got to see the same thing in the UK with the Liberal Democrats. As soon as those sorts of parties get into that position and have to make the hard decisions for the country and can't just live up to the fairies at the bottom of the garden sort of principles, they die. And so one of the reasons is we've never actually managed to sustain that sort of, you know, third party of a practical kind. Most of our third parties are of the theoretical non-governing kind, but government kills them, and that's part of the reason that it just hasn't worked the same way as in Canada.
Can I make one last comment? When I was a correspondent in London half a million years ago, I met the famous Sir John Kerr. I had a great lunch with Sir John Kerr, who was in exile, and who was in fine form after a few glasses of whatever he was drinking at lunch, saying how wrong-headed and spiteful all the Australians were, and how he was right and history would prove him right. And the reason I was invited to this lunch was because you asked for readings, okay? There is a very famous book, it's faded, of course, by a man in Canada who was a great public figure and constitutionalist, among other things, named Eugene Forsey, who became a senator. And he wrote a book called The Royal Power of Dissolution in the British Commonwealth.
Yep, got that.
You got it. My God, Jesus. This woman is weird. Seriously weird. Even weirder. Oh, my God. At any rate, Forsey, who was a great, great man, I got to know him later in his life. This book, The Royal Power of Dissolution, as you know, asserts vigorously that the Queen, or the monarch, I should say, and therefore the monarch's representative, has a very extensive reserve power. And when he heard about what Sir John Kerr had done in Australia, and the fact that he was being criticized roundly for exercising this royal power, this reserve power, he contacted Sir John, Forsey being in Ottawa and Kerr now being in England. And when Forsey came to London, as he did for a couple of months every year, took a room in the Commonwealth Club, he and Kerr got together. And Kerr was thrilled to have a constitutionalist of some considerable renown, who'd written this great tome of which you have two copies, entirely supporting his position, since almost nobody back home was. So they had many fine conversations, feeding on each other, bucking each other up, and I got invited by Forsey to come and meet Sir John Kerr. So I met the famous man, and I had a long liquid lunch with him at one of the clubs in London. And when I saw his portrait the other day over in Canberra, they had a list of the Governor Generals, I thought back to that very pleasant lunch we had.
Well, Geoffrey and Anne, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating discussion because you've come from completely different perspectives and two different countries. I've learned a hell of a lot, and I'm sure everyone else has. It'll be on the podcast, I presume, tomorrow. You can pinch it and send it to anyone you like. And we'll have papers published online when I get out the next volume of the Sydney papers. Thanks to the Canadian High Commission again. Thanks to Clayton Yutz, and thanks to our speakers.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.